And thank you all for the opportunity to be here with you. I'm honored by this invitation because South Church has a beautiful and well-earned reputation as a space of hospitality and creative and inspirational thinking and learning. And so I've been in this space many times and left the better for it. So thank you so much. And I'm grateful for the chance to reflect about this moment that we're living in and what I believe these times are asking of us, because these are truly extraordinary times that we're in. In some ways, in many ways, they are truly horrible, with cause for profound fear and sadness and anger. So much is being frayed or threatened, or in some cases destroyed right in front of us, that's going to take a long time to put back together. Sometimes these are times of numbness and overwhelm and disconnect and confusion. We wonder if words are losing their meaning, if our democracy is real, if our institutions can survive the assault and the subversion. And also these are times of profound hope for what is possible, an exhilarating sense of our capacity to fill streets and maintain vigils and marches and to again and again dramatically outnumber those who would come to tear us apart. So this is in that way a time of clarity and a stronger sense of community than some of us have felt in our whole lives. And I want to bear witness to that and to invite you to think about how the New Poor People's Campaign is a way that we can build power for social and economic transformation in the country, in our states, right here in the Seacoast. So some quick history. On December 4, 1967, Dr. King announced plans for a Poor People's Campaign to organize people, especially affected people, directly affected people, to end poverty, racism, and militarism in America, what he called the triple evils. And at that time, we were a terribly divided nation, particularly around the Vietnam War and issues of racial justice. But the plan was to bring poor people together from all parts of the country to demand better. Ralph Abernathy at the time said, "We're going to dramatize the plight of America's poor people of all races and make clear that we're sick and tired of waiting for a better life." Dr. King said, "We need to create a new and very unsettling force." And we've seen at several points in history how truly terrifying it can be to those in power when marginalized and disenfranchised people refuse to be pitted against each other, but instead find common cause in their stories and start to organize for a more just society. If you don't know some of those moments in history, I encourage you to look and find them. So Dr. King described this gathering of poor and affected people as a multiracial, nonviolent army of the poor, a freedom church of the poor. And in the last Sunday sermon he would ever give, he said, "We are going to bring the tired, the poor, the huddled masses. We're going to come to demand that the government address itself finally to the problem of poverty. We're going to ask America to be true to that promissory note that it signed years ago, and we're going to engage in dramatic, nonviolent action. We're going to make the invisible visible." And great leaders like Gene Sharp, I'm so glad he was invoked in this space, and Dr. King and Barbara Deming and other leaders of nonviolent action tell us that nonviolent action itself doesn't create the crisis so much as it makes what was invisible visible so that it can no longer be ignored. And the campaign had three phases. There was a resurrection city where 3,000 poor people lived in tents on the National Mall. There were large demonstrations, mass nonviolent civil disobedience, and then a boycott intended to force Congress to implement an economic bill of rights. Well, Dr. King was assassinated on April 4th, right in the final weeks of the of the rollout of this big campaign. But the movement decided to move forward anyway. And there were caravans that came from the east, from Appalachia, from the south, from Native peoples' territories, from San Francisco. And 3,000 of them lived in the pouring rain for days on the National Mall. And there might be some people in this congregation who remember seeing that on the news or perhaps were there as young children. I love encountering stories from people who were there. But they were demanding jobs, housing, the end to punitive welfare restrictions. They were demanding that farm workers get included in the labor protections that had been passed in Congress and to restore budget cuts to essential programs. Well, so the campaign happened, but the assassination of Dr. King and Senator Robert Kennedy were traumatizing moments in our nation's time, and the unity of all of those movements was hard to sustain. And many people would agree that the campaign didn't go on to have the transformative effect that its organizers hoped. So here we are now, 50 years later, and for quite some time, the Reverend Dr. William Barber, from the Moral Mondays movement in North Carolina, and he was the head of the statewide NAACP until fairly recently in North Carolina, has joined with the Reverend Liz Theo Harris of the Cairo Center, and they're talking about creating, they are more than talking about it now, creating a new Poor People's Campaign. Not as a commemoration, there's not really time or energy for a whole lot of commemorating, but to take up the work again. Because not only was that project of 50 years ago not complete, but by many measures, the evils that Dr. King pointed to are worse today than they were 5 decades ago. And if you add in climate change and other environmental threats that weren't even at the forefront of those organizers' minds, the picture's even more grim. So Dr. Barber has this idea, this call to us, that we must recognize the need for locally organized, state-based, state capital-focused, because that's where we can make the change, deeply moral and constitutional, anti-racist, anti-poverty, pro-justice, pro-labor, pro-GLBTQ, transformative movement building. And there's no shortcut to do this work authentically. These movements have to be nurtured and built from the ground up, and we must create a movement of movements. Because in the last 50 years, we've seen a 60% increase in the number of people living in poverty, while the top 1% have nearly doubled the wealth that they hold, the share of the wealth they hold. 23 states have passed racist voter suppression laws just since 2010, including in New Hampshire. We now spend $7.5 billion on prisons at the federal level, $17 billion on this machine of immigration enforcement and detention and deportation. And more than half of every one of our discretionary tax dollars is going directly to the military, while our single greatest threat to global security is climate change, something that was not even mentioned in the State of the Union. So we've got to organize in order to demand a change in course. Our faith traditions, but also our state and our federal constitutions, all testify to the immorality of an economy that leaves out the poor. But our political discourse consistently ignores the 140 million poor and low-income people living in this country. So we have to demand the implementation of a moral agenda that serves the common good, not particularized religious beliefs. That's a moral agenda that serves the common good. And in New Hampshire, which is what I know, I'm sure this congregation welcomes people from Maine, and I care about Maine too, but it's New Hampshire's policies that are most in my mind because I work on them all the time. We need equal access to higher quality education. We need living wages. We don't even have a state minimum wage. We have to default to the really inadequate federal minimum wage. We need family and medical leave, paid sick leave. We need a contract, Our state workers have been out of a contract for more than 200 days, and an incentive to kind of keep them at the bargaining table and turn up the pressure on them, the administration, our state administration, refused to authorize the $200 boot allowance that we give out every year to transportation workers so that they can have new boots to work in the cold. We need secure access to health care. I know that's an issue that cuts across many states. 50,000 people are benefiting from expanded Medicaid in New Hampshire, but it's always at risk of being taken away. We need fair and adequate taxes so that we stop pretending we're a poor state and we realize we've got plenty of money to invest in the things that we care about. We need an effective response to our opioid crisis. We need transgender non-discrimination protections, which thankfully are in the works, and hopefully we'll win that fight. We need protections for air, soil, the water at Seabrook, the water at Pease. Those take investments of public dollars to ensure the oversight. And we need to protect the whole of our environment. And lastly, for now, we need to make it easier to vote, not harder to vote, and to promote full civic participation by all of our people. So the new Poor People's Campaign's getting built. Nationally, it was launched on December 4. We did a launch here in New Hampshire as well. We had our first organizing meeting in Manchester with 60-plus people on December 14th. We've got tri-chairs, so a three-chairperson committee structure, a coordinating committee that includes youth, faith and labor representatives, people of color, people with lived experience of poverty and homelessness. We have immigrants. We have upcoming regional organizing meetings, one in Nashua. Susan Dewhurst is a part of the organizing of a Seacoast regional planning meeting that will be in Dover in early March, one in Keene, one in the North Country. There's a big press conference tomorrow to kind of draw more attention to that. We'll be doing nonviolent civil disobedience training, teach-ins. We've gathered song leaders, videographers, education coordinators. And then the action phase of this campaign kicks off on Mother's Day of 2018 with 40 days of education, relationship building, mobilization, and where it's strategically valuable, coordinated civil disobedience. This will be happening around the country, culminating with some major demonstrations in Washington and in state capitals in late June. And then we live into where we go from here with a strengthened capacity for social change, with stronger relationships, bigger networks, a bigger movement. So downstairs there are pledge cards you can sign to get enrolled in the database and receive the New Hampshire-specific or Maine-specific information and stay informed about that. So for better and for worse, we have been born into these times, and it seems clear that we have to fight a robust and a nonviolent fight to protect everything we care about. We have to fight for ourselves, and we have to fight for people who are more vulnerable than we are, and hopefully fight alongside them, people who are targeted and who have been told in some ways that we are coming for you. And I, as a Quaker, believe that this must be a nonviolent fight in order for beloved community to be the result of the end of it. We need to hold the possibility of us coming together in beloved community. And we do that by remembering that we carry the divine light in all of us. So I want to just quickly mention a few of the people that I want to fight for and that I want to walk alongside in this work. Most of my work is in immigration, so my first story comes out of that reality in New Hampshire. And the immigration policy, our current immigration crisis, is an example of a really horrible intersection of other issues you may care about: mass incarceration, racism, economic exploitation, xenophobia, as well as historical amnesia. So every Monday, I'll see her tomorrow, I visit a woman named Maria at the Stafford County Jail, which has the contract for holding Immigration and Customs Enforcement detainees. She's been there since April. Her four children and her elderly mother and her husband and a grandchild all live in Manchester, and they have been aching for her to be released. But Maria was convicted of a felony because in 2005, we made the act of returning to the United States after a deportation, we made that a felony. So she had to plead guilty to that because the facts were quite obvious. And she's been awaiting sentencing, which she just was given. So that action in our Congress in 2005 of making a second or third return to the U.S. a felony was a deliberate act to make sure then that we could call a larger group of people criminals, so that we could criminalize people whose action of being here is rooted in so many wholesome impulses, seeking safety, being here for love, being here to take care of their families. So on Wednesday, I listened in the courtroom in the federal court in Concord as she explained to the judge that she feels horrible for having violated the laws of America. But she said, "But I have a family and difficult circumstances, and every time I had to leave this country, it was because of an emergency. I didn't leave my children here and go to Mexico for pleasure. It was always urgent. And that trip was costly to me, not only monetarily, but because of the danger that was always present when I made that journey. But what could I do? I had to return to my children, to my mother who's sick. I had to be here to care for my family." So she is now praying for a miracle in order to be able to stay here. She has an excellent attorney, but her story reflects a system that does not take her humanity into account. The system that's detaining her does not exist to protect her or her due process rights. That isn't its purpose. That system doesn't even, in my opinion, exist to protect us. There's a lot of money being made in this system of immigration enforcement, and we have to challenge that at its core. And it's a system that we allowed to be built in our name, so we feel, I hope we feel some responsibility for it. I also want to fight for and with my friend Gina, who courageously prepared last week to offer testimony in a House legislative hearing for a bill that would add gender identity to the non-discrimination statute in the state. And I felt a lot of joy as I watched her seated in the hearing room, and the halls were packed with hundreds of people, a lot of transgender people and their allies. In fact, the room and the halls were so packed they had to move the hearing to Representatives Hall, the 400-seat room. But as I sat with her, I winced as I heard the stereotypes and the accusations being made of the threat that her identity poses to women and to children. And I saw her hands shake as she listened to those who put the value of her personhood up for debate. And so she wondered if it was even going to be safe to describe in front of all of those people the danger that she herself has felt living in this world in her body. I want us to fight for all the people whose access to health care is provided by the New Hampshire Health Protection Program. I don't know why we continue to parcel out this life-saving program in two-year increments with new requirements added at every turn, as if we aren't a wealthy state with plenty of capacity to do the right thing. I don't know why we allow our officials to constantly create new hoops that low-income people have to jump through in order to justify their worthiness for the public assistance that we give them. But I think part of the problem is that we haven't made sure that the voices of impoverished people are in the room when those decisions are being made, and that those of us who are in the room maybe aren't fighting hard enough to defend them. And lastly, I want to fight for my friend Grace. She's on my mind because before I left my house this morning, she posted "Praise God" on her Facebook page because her car got through inspection in January. She has a January birthday. And so she and her three kids weren't going to have to live with the stress of another big car repair bill that might have prevented her from getting it registered. Because there are so many households in the United States where there's just not enough for bad surprises like that. So those are the people on my mind as I think about getting ready to participate in this broader campaign. And as we do this work, we have to do our own work of learning and strengthening ourselves to show up, but we also have to do it in community. We aren't going to go very far if we don't travel as community. We're not going to understand the fullness of what we're seeing if we don't do this work in community. We're not going to know when it's time, perhaps, for civil disobedience unless we're discerning that in community. We're not going to stay strong or have somebody to cover us when we need a break if we don't do this work in community. But even at a strategic level, we need community because we need such a variety of gifts and talents. We need lawyers because in these times there are fights to be fought in front of judges and in courthouses. But lawyers aren't going to save us because our laws aren't strong enough. We need elected officials and people who vote to expand our sense of what we can achieve with public policy. But they by themselves aren't going to do that work unless there are also people in the streets who are making it not only safe for our elected officials to be brave and progressive in their ideas, but to make it hard for them to do otherwise so that they feel the pressure. And I also believe that we need prayers. I have seen too many moments where a way is made where there seemed to be no way, or capacity is opened up when it seems like there's no more. So the work isn't always going to be clear. It isn't always going to be very satisfying, but it is the work to be done in these times. So I want to just close by sharing briefly some words from Dr. King about our call to remaining maladjusted in a society that would rob us and others of our full potential. There are certain things in our nation and in the world which I am proud to be maladjusted, which I hope all people of goodwill will be maladjusted. I never intend to become adjusted to segregation and discrimination. I never intend to become adjusted to bigotry or to adjust myself to economic conditions that take the economic necessities from some and give luxuries to the few. I never intend to adjust myself to the madness of militarism or the self-defeating effects of physical violence. So we're living in a great moment. We are going to be each other's community. We will be maladjusted together as people of hope, as people who learn about our history and take courage from those examples. And I hope that we feel abundantly blessed for this work that we'll do together. Thank you.